Today on the program, you're going to have a chance to hear some pretty cool insect sounds. As a matter of fact, I think we're going to be able to not only hear them, but visually describe them for you as well, because we've got a couple of guys who can do just that. Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger are our guests today, and they're the co-authors of the book, The Songs of Insects. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Lang Elliott is the creator and owner of Nature Sound Studio in Ithaca, New York. He's been a frequent guest on this program. Will is an award-winning photographer and recordist and has been president of local chapters of the National Audubon Society and the Maryland Ornithological Society as well. So really happy to have them with us today. And certainly if you have questions as we move along today and talk about these insects and their songs, I hope you'll join in. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments, and let's see if we got Lang. Lang, are you there? I got him on here. Lang Elliott, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, there you
can
go.
You hear me?
Yeah,
okay.
I got you. I've got you now.
Okay.
And Will Hershberger.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being with us today as well. Really appreciate it. Well, this is a stunning book. The photography in this book is absolutely fantastic, and the descriptions of the insects are wonderful as well. How did you guys happen to get together? And this must have taken some time to put together.
It sure did. Will, you want to tell the story?
Okay. Well, the project kind of initiated with both of us separately, as it turns out. Back in for Lang in the early 90s and for myself in the mid and late 90s, we had kind of an idea running around in our head about some kind of project similar to this. And a chance meeting at another artist's house in Frederick County, Maryland, introduced Lang and myself to each other. And so then in 2000, Lang calls up and says, it's time. You want to do a book project on the singing insects. And that's how it got started.
Took us six and, of course, years. We thought we would finish it in like 2 or 3 years.
And here it is 7 years later.
7 years later, but things take time. We had a number of field trips we took over the years, and we had to hone our photography. Like in the book, there are the shots of all the insects on a white surface.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it look like they're standing on the page of the book, along with the vegetation shots. But we were ways into it before we decided to do that for all the insects. We had to go back and collect a number, you know, new specimens for the photography and go through a whole extra procedure to do that.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a stunning result.
Well, thank you.
no question about that. Well, how did you get, why this big interest in insects? Well, why are you so interested in these singing insects?
Well, what really got me started, I got started recording bird songs in the mid-90s, and toward the end of summer and fall, the birds grow silent,
right?
And all these insects are singing. So I trained my microphone on the insects and found out pretty quickly that cassette machines weren't going to do it. So I upgraded to a digital audio tape recorder, and that really did the trick. So I got really interested in recording all these insects, and it just grew from there.
And Lang, how about you?
Well, I think that insect sound, everyone hears it. I mean, it just it can be overwhelming, you know, the strong choruses in late summer and autumn. But in North America, there's been no practical guides, since a lot of these things sing at night and they're small, or they sing up in the trees during the day. You can't see who's doing it. You can't find them very easily.
Yep.
So people have been unable really to focus on that, because what do? You hear it, and if you can't find it and there isn't anyone there to tell you what it is, then you're sort of out of luck. So we decided to try to open that up, to just take this whole arena of sound and make it accessible to people, and we really think we've done it with this book.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Which of the insects, tell people which insects you have in the book.
Well,
Yeah, what we tried to focus on were the insects that actually sing. And if you define song as an auditory utterance that defends a territory or attracts a mate, then all of the insects in this book actually sing. So we tried to, you know, a lot of insects will make noises. The cerambycid beetles make noises, they eat, and that kind of thing. But these are the insects that actually sing to attract mates. So that's how we kind of narrowed the field down as to what to include in the book.
Yeah, and what they are the crickets, the katydids, and the cicadas, and then also a group of grasshoppers called the locusts.
Now, when you say sing... is it like how are the sounds produced? Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I'll take part of this. Amongst the crickets and the katydids, it's done with the wings. The wings, especially the forewings, at the base of the forewings, there's modifications so that on one wing there is a structure called the file. On the opposing wing, there's a structure called the scraper. So they rub the file against the scraper, and it sets up a vibration, and then membranes of the wings may amplify the vibration. And so what you hear when you hear these trills or scrapes or shuffles or ticks, they're generally the movement of one wing against the other.
So that's a cricket.
That's a cricket.
And hold on a second. Let's see if I can pull one of those up.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, friends, to the Songs of Insects, the companion audio compact disc to the book The Songs of Insects by Lang Elliott and myself, Will Hirschberger. The choruses of late summer and fall are often overlooked and underappreciated. It is our hope with this guide to increase the pleasure of your sojourns in the fields and woods during this magical time of insect song. Spring Field Cricket, Gryllus velitus.
Okay, so now they're doing that with their wings, Lang.
Yeah, there's just a little shuffle of the wings for each of those chirps, and if you watched a field cricket doing that, it would have its wings elevated when it produces the song, and you would see the vibration as you heard the sound.
So it's kind of like maybe if we scraped on a comb?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Very similar, although sometimes it's more melodic. Sometimes it sounds sort of dissonant, like a comb wood, but it varies. The crickets in general are more musical in the sounds they produce, while the katydids are more amusical, I guess you could say. Non-musical.
Non-musical.
Yeah.
So, and the katydids also use their wings?
Yes.
Let me just see if I've got a katydid up here.
Short-winged meadow katydid.
Oh,
Conocephalus brevipennis.
That's gonna be a very high-pitched
one. Songs of one male, followed by songs of another male.
Very high pitch, Dave. Well, let's see.
Yeah, try the common true katydid.
All right, we'll try that.
It's one a lot of people know.
Let me see here. What number is that? That is. I'll have to look that one. I'm not finding it.
43.
43. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that now I can. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's play that one.
Common true katydid. Pterophylla camellifolia. The northern race, followed by the southeastern race, followed by a pulsating chorus.
Ah.
That's what you would hear in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and that sounds a lot like katydid, too.
Katydid. Yeah. Yes.
What's the there's a great story, just as an aside, that I can't remember where I got it now, how the katydid got its name.
Oh yeah, there's several stories. The one we tell in the book is that there was a young woman named Katie who had a boyfriend she was very much in love with, but he jilted her and took up with another woman, married another woman, and then shortly after he got married, come morning, somebody discovered the man and his wife poisoned laying in bed, dead. And they wondered, you know, how did this happen? And everyone thought that Katie did it, of course, but they didn't have any proof. But it all happened in the darkness of the night, and the insects were very awake, and they saw everything. So to this day, they give the answer to that puzzle. Katie did.
Oh, I love that story. That's a great story. Well, so we've talked about crickets and katydids for a minute, but you also have some others in there as well, grasshoppers and cicadas.
Yes, go ahead, Will.
Yes, the grasshoppers, the shorthorn grasshoppers, the locusts, produce sound in some of them, they rub their legs against their wings. So on the inside surface of their leg is a series of pegs, and as they bring their leg down across the edge of the wing, it makes a sound. So they alternate back and forth, pumping their legs up and down to make these shushing sounds. Other grasshoppers or locusts, the band-winged grasshoppers, crepitate, and that is a sound that they make while in flight. They actually kind of pop the wings really taut, and it makes a snapping sound. And they do it when they're flushed by a predator, or you'll sometimes on a warm summer day see them hovering a few feet off the ground trying to attract a mate.
That's cool.
Could you play that one? That would be track 62.
Sure, we can play that.
Yeah, it's a real neat sound. A lot of people have heard it when they're out in a summer day on a sandy road and scaring up these things.
Let's listen.
Scissor grinder cicada.
Oop.
To bison pruinosa.
Wrong one, 62.
Oh, 62, sorry.
Sorry, I may have said it wrong.
Let's try that one.
Bowls and Carolina grasshoppers. Spharagamon boli, Indisostyra carolina. The following examples of crepitation are from a Carolina grasshopper.
Sort of a fluttery, ticky sound.
You know what that reminds me of? When I was a kid, on my bicycle, I attached some playing cards to the spokes.
Oh, yeah.
and that's what it that's what, yeah, it reminds me of.
It's similar. It's just shorter in duration. But, yeah. And when the band wings fly, you see the bands. They're called band wings because when they spread their wings, they're multicolored, often black and orange or yellow.
Uh-huh.
So they're quite obvious as they fly away or when they're hovering in courtship flight, and then you hear that sound that goes along with it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger are guests today. They are the authors of the book, The Songs of Insects. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm having some fun talking with them. And certainly if you want to join in with questions or comments, you're most welcome. Here's the number to call. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Giving you a little oral and visual journey through the insect world today with Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger, who have authored the book The Songs of Insects, published by Houghton Mifflin. And tell you what, some wonderful photography, some great information about the birds and their songs, and an accompanying CD, as you have been listening to. Again, if you want to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. And let's take a call. Paulette and Mesa Maney, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Paulette.
Hi there. Well, one of the great pieces of news is that two summers ago we had a drought, and we never saw a mosquito in Mesa Maney since. Before that, we had them by the trillions and billions and quadrillions, and that isn't my main question, though. My main one is as many people have, earwigs, and they usually come up on my front porch. And I've even had one in bed and here and there, and I just want to learn how to prevent them. And that's one of my main concerns, plus any other insects that we might be getting in our house. What are the best ways to get rid of them? Because now I'm where I really need some help with that. We also had carpenter ants, but that's not probably on their list. But
no,
I'm certainly happy that I found a smart person who saw billions of them crawling up and down my trees. And when he took care of the trees, we had no more carpenter ants.
Well, I don't know if we can have Lang Elliott. Do you want to take a shot at it?
Well, two things. Number one, none of the insects you mentioned are singing insects, so they don't fall within the venue of our book. And then, of course, another important fact here is that neither Will nor I are actually entomologists, per se. So we're actually maybe not qualified to answer your questions, but I do have a story about earwigs. from a TV show I saw, I think it was The Twilight Zone or something like that. You know, the folklore was that they burrow into your ear.
Yeah.
And then in this movie, they burrow in and they lay eggs in a person's brain.
Or they
drill around in the brain. They don't really do this. But and it can kill a person. So there was this, it was set in somewhere in Southeast Asia, and there was an older man with a young wife, and then another man who was lusting after the young wife. So he decided he wanted to kill the older man. Kill the husband. So he got an earwig from a local sort of witch doctor type, and he was supposed to, you know, let it loose there in the bed, and it would crawl into the guy's ear and drill into his brain and kill him. But what happened is he shook the little jar, but it didn't come out, and he didn't realize it because they're so little. So he went back in his room and sort of threw the jar there on the bed. And then while he was sleeping, the earwig drilled into his ear. And then they found that out, you know, and he said what he did and everything, and as he thought he was going to die. But he somehow survived this thing as it drilled through his brain, then came out the other side. So he was quite a happy man until the doctor informed him that the earwig had laid eggs in his brain.
Oh,
so at the very end of the show, you just heard him screaming as all this rain fell on the Southeast Asian setting. So that's my earwig story. It has nothing to do with what she asked, but there it is.
Okay. Will, a comment from you? Will, are you?
Will?
Wait a second here. Did we lose Will? Hold on. Let's see if we can get him.
Oh, we might have lost Will.
No, hold on a second here. We'll get him back.
Now, carpenter ants make sounds, but they're not courtship sounds.
Will, are you there? No, I've got you now.
I think so.
Okay, go ahead. If any comments from you on that?
It's a wild story, isn't it? earwigs are really attracted to moist areas, wood piles, that kind of thing. One of the things I've heard is to put out some dampened newspaper in areas where they're getting into the house.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the newspaper outside, and then they'll be attracted to that pile of damp newspaper, and you can just ball it all up and throw it away, and it gets rid of them.
Oh.
There you go. Well,
there's a good non-chemical way to have a go at it.
Yep.
Thanks for calling. If you'd like to join in as we visit with Lang and Will today about the oral and visual, we're giving an oral and visual journey through the insect world with them today. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Are the cicadas, are they much louder than crickets and katydids? Or?
Yes, definitely. They're the loudest of the singing insects. And they produce sound with a completely different mechanism. They're in a completely different family. But they have small structures on the side of their abdomen called timbals. And these timbals have thickened ridges inside, and attached to those ridges are very strong muscles that contract and make that timbal pop. And as they relax, the timbal pops back out. They're very rapid contractions and relaxations of those muscles create this buzzing sound that's extraordinarily loud. And the fascinating thing is their ears are right beside the timbal. So how they can still hear after singing, I don't know. But it is the loudest of the singing insects.
So that was another question I actually had. How do the other insects, how does one cricket hear another and so forth, but they all have ears of some sort or hearing mechanisms?
Yes, go ahead, Will.
Yeah, the crickets and katydids' ears are actually on their front legs at what we would consider our forearm. They have these small pockets with a thin membrane that acts as their ear. And each individual species seems to be tuned to the frequencies of its own species' song. So they can really detect one another no matter what the temperature is. All of these things are cold-blooded, so of course they slow down as they get cold. And but they can still determine what species belongs to them, no matter what the temperature.
And they probably are tuned in some way to the temporal patterning of their own songs, so that even when there's a lot of other noise around, they are hearing each other very clearly, sort of preferentially, I guess you would say.
Well, you know, we do that too.
Oh, yes, we definitely do.
if you've ever been at a party where it's noisy and you're talking to someone and suddenly you hear your name mentioned behind you.
Yeah.
there's
a template in your mind that picks that up and says, listen, you know, somebody's calling you.
Let's go to Mark in Racine next. Mark, hi to you.
Hi. My question was, did they include any animals in their book that may be confused with insects, such as toads that sort of sound like insects?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, actually, we did not. That's interesting. And there are certainly a number of other animal sounds that somebody might think are insects. For instance, some people that are unfamiliar with spring peepers in the spring think they're hearing crickets off in the distance.
Yeah.
And there are a number of frogs, actually, that have chirping calls, like the oak toad in the south has a high-pitched kind of sound that you might think was an insect song, and there's some trilling frogs that sound like insects, mostly the frogs, though. Maybe occasionally some bird sounds, but no, we didn't address that at all.
That was an interesting note, though, from Mark. Mark, thanks.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. And let's see. Let's take another call here and go to Greg in Upper Michigan. Let's see. I'm having some trouble with my fingers today. My fingers aren't doing the walking like they should here. Greg in Upper Michigan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question. I think it's either a pine beetle or a pine sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And when you grab one and hold on to it, it makes the strangest sound, like a growling almost or a croaking. And I was just wondering how they make that sound.
Yeah.
Well, good question. I'm not really sure. Is it a beetle, like an adult that you grab a hold of?
Yes, it's an adult beetle. They're quite large, probably about an inch long.
Yeah. And with long antennae?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like a Cerambycid-type beetle. And again, I mean, I don't know. Will, do you know anything about this? I'm not familiar with that sound.
No, I'm not familiar with it either, unless it's just moving the pronotum against the head. I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, you're sort of stepping out of our arena again, which is the singing insects. But I remember encountering once I was at a friend of mine, Doug Elliott, of no relation, but he dug into a log, a rotting log, and found a beetle he called a Bessie bug. Well, it was a bug, not a beetle. And when you grabbed it, it would make these fussy sounds, fussy notes that I recorded, but I have no idea how they actually do it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I haven't seen any studies, but again, you know, we're not professional entomologists. Tom Walker down at the University of Florida, who's an expert on crickets and katydids, he would probably have an answer to that, but it is outside of the arena of insect song.
Let's go to Pat in Wausau next. Pat, hi to you.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the story on the Ewigs.
Yeah.
Because I saw that television show.
You did.
And it was Lawrence Harvey who had the Ewig eggs in his brain.
Oh, my God.
And I've been afraid of Ewigs my whole life, and that's what started me listening to you today. I'm thinking, I wonder if they're going to say whether they really go in your ear or not, and I'm so happy that they don't.
I answered your question. Amazing.
If they made it to your ear, it would be totally by accident.
Well,
that was it Twilight Zone or some other?
I'm not sure if it might have been Twilight Zone. I know it was black and white, and I can still see a young Lawrence Harvey holding his head and screaming at the end.
Oh, at the end, yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
So it's one less thing for me to worry about.
It is, Pat.
They're not to be worried about. Earwigs are to be loved.
Okay.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions or comments. There's a story about a cricket whose chirps can tell the temperature.
Oh, yeah. Will, you want to do that one?
Will?
Yeah, the snowy tree cricket, sometimes called the temperature cricket, gives a pretty good approximation of the ambient temperature. If you count the number of chirps in 13 seconds and add that number to 40, it gives you a really close approximation of the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit.
That's track 11 if you want to play it.
Yeah, let's put that up. That'd be fun to listen to. So, and then you're going to have to tell us again. You count the number of chirps in what is it again? Will, you count the number of chirps in...
In 13 seconds.
In 13 seconds.
Add 40 to that.
And add 40, plus 40. Okay. Well, let's see if we can come up with the number 11 here.
Snowy tree cricket, Acanthus fultoni. Songs of a warm male, followed by songs of a very cold male.
Oh, cold.
Yeah. Cold. You can now hear the individual pulses in a chirp.
Yeah. So that's getting near the end of the season.
Yes, or just an early cold night. But yeah, that was probably done in late September, early October, the last one.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Lewis in Marshfield will give you a chance to. Hi, Lewis.
How are you doing, Larry? Love your program. Getting back to your earwigs, I remember the I remember that show on TV, and that was Alfred Hitchcock.
Hitchcock, of course. That would be the other choice. All right.
Yeah. Scared the heck out of me when I was a kid.
It did me, too.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, now we know it was Alfred Hitchcock. Mike in Arlington, it's your turn. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
Got a question, and I'm not sure if this is going to be answerable or not.
Yeah.
I had an incident with I think it's pronounced a polyphemus moth.
Mm-hmm.
And I know moths are not generally considered to be noisemakers, but this was, during the short period of time where they're out and doing their mating business. One was on the side of the house, and I disturbed it, and it happened to fly and land on my head directly behind my ear, and I could hear almost like a subsonic, or feel more like a subsonic vibration that it would make in a kind of a pulsing pattern. I was wondering, is that something that is like a mating call for the moth?
Well, we're getting some questions here that I'm unfamiliar with that. Maybe it was actually, producing a vibration that you were feeling or half hearing. But again, I've never experienced that. I know nothing about it. How about you, Will?
Yeah, there are a number of insects, particularly leaf hoppers, that communicate with one another through substrate vibrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine a moth would be doing that. They seem to communicate with one another using pheromones, but maybe it was trembling the flight muscles or something.
Yeah, because, I mean, certainly when I've done recordings, nighttime recordings, especially soundscapes, I have heard moths fly by, and there is a lot of low-frequency sound that they're making, like just the flight noise, the sound of their wings, the flutter of their wings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite stunning sometimes to have one, like, fly right in front of the mic when I'm sitting 100 feet away with headphones on, and then I hear this large thing just go, vroom, as it goes by. So
well,
it could vibrate, maybe be vibrating its wings back there if you couldn't see it. So you might hear a fluttering or something.
Somebody else mentioned mosquitoes earlier, and mosquitoes definitely make a buzzing sound. Is it? I assume that's probably their wings as well, then.
Yeah, and I believe that, actually, I mean, that, in the case of the mosquito, I believe the sound is used in courtship.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, is that right, Will?
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and although we did not include that, but that might be something that would fall under the venue of insect song, mm-hmm, of sorts. But, yeah, I don't know much about that either.
Stephen and Jefferson, let's go to Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was wondering if there were any mockingbirds in the insect world that sound like other insects.
Oh.
Maybe to lure them to the dinner table.
Uh-huh.
Interesting question.
What do you think, Will?
I've not heard examples of that, no.
You've not heard examples of that. So primarily then the songs that they make are for two things, sex, kind of, and stay out of my area.
Yeah, territorial kind of right, effect on other males.
Yeah. Now, there are some predators.
Yeah, that home in.
Yeah, there are some predators of the katydids that will home in on specific songs. So, like, the song of a fork-tailed bush katydid might attract a certain species of this predatory wasp right to the male. So there is some risk in singing.
Right. And probably at night, like, bats could hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And home in on the insects not only by using their sonar, you know, to catch flying insects, but they might actually home in on sounds, an insect making sounds and perched like on a twig where they could see it with their sonar as well.
Hmm, interesting. Well, now we have a controversy brewing here because several people have called in to say, no, it wasn't Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, okay.
Others are claiming it was Night Gallery.
Could be.
So I'm just going to have to go online or something.
So the earwig story is generating some buzz.
So to speak. Oh, Ed in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Ed.
Hi. On hot, humid Wisconsin summer mornings, maybe like 7, 8, 9, maybe as late as 10 in the morning, there's a, I believe it's an insect that makes a high-pitched kind of like voltage sound almost. Goes probably like 10, 20 seconds at least and increases in intensity and
uh-huh,
pitch as the time goes on. And could you talk about that or explain that?
Sure.
Yeah, we know what that is, Will.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what species. You want to take it, Will?
Yeah, it's definitely a cicada. And it's one of the dog day cicadas, I would imagine, the buzzsaw type cicadas.
Yeah, if it's a continuous sort of piercing buzz that starts off, gets loud, and then peters out at the end and lasts about 15 seconds, then that would be Tobison canicularis, the
right,
dog day cicada.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that one, so let me hang on there, Ed. We'll see if we can call that up. Here we go.
Dog day cicada, Tobison canicularis. One song each of two males.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Ed. Ed, is that what you're hearing?
That might be it. I was just wondering why it's the hot, humid summer mornings that cause it opposed to...
the cicadas typically start singing in the heat of the summer, and they sing during the day, unlike a lot of the crickets and katydids are mostly at night, not entirely by any means. But the cicadas are only at day, although there's some species that give a spurt of song at dusk.
Right.
So it appears that when they heat up, they start singing. They sing best for many species when they're hot.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be singing from the trees. And a lot of the cicadas have pulsations, you know, not just a buzz that gets louder and peters out, but as it gets louder, you hear it going like, zia, 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 zia. A really good example is the scissor grinder cicada, which is track 63. You want to play that?
Yeah, let's go back to...
It's a good one.
Yeah, okay. Let's try that one.
Scissor grinder cicada, Tobison pruinosa.
Huh. Sounds like some of the little motorcycles that take off around campus.
And actually, I just looked on the map. That species is not found in, appears to not be in Wisconsin. But there are others that do that. Bison linnaei sounds similar to that with the pulsations. But then there's a couple of northern cicadas that sort of just have continuous trills that don't have that typical starting soft and then petering out at the end.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. And let's go to Jackie in Plymouth next. Jackie, hi to you.
Hello, hello. I'm so delighted to have this program on. It's so seldom that people really get to hear about the insects and bugs, although I know you're not talking about bugs. And related to that is, I think, could you talk a little bit about noise pollution and the how that is, if it is interfering with the mating ability of insects and things like that? And another thought came to my mind was, too, that I just don't see as many insects and bugs around these days. I think they're just being wiped out not only by pesticides, but cars driving. I remember when I was a younger girl, my windshield would just be full of insects, and that doesn't seem the case.
Hmm.
Will, do you want to comment?
The hypothesis is that the louder background noises become, the less successful any animal that relies on sound communication will be at mating. In fact, I was recording Wilson's warblers, a type of bird in California, along a logging road, and it was incredibly loud there. And those warblers were singing much louder than other Wilson's warblers I had recorded, so they were trying to compensate. So whether the insects are doing something similar or being impacted by noise pollution would be another line of study. But
right, I don't know of any studies. Another thing to keep in mind is the insects really are singing mostly in the higher registers, at least of human hearing.
Right.
And noise pollution is primarily at the lower end, like rumble or the noise of traffic. So in some circumstances, there could be a lot of perceived noise, but when you look at the frequency band in which the insects are singing, there's far less.
Right, exactly.
So you could have a noisy industrial area, but then crickets chirping along quite happily that are separated by frequency, and they're not being impacted. That's not to say they aren't impacted. It's something to keep in mind. Another thing, actually, I'd like to mention at this point, earlier in the program, I sort of cut you off when you started playing the short-winged meadow katydid.
Yeah.
Because that and a number of other species are really at the upper range of human hearing. For instance, Will has excellent ears, but has to be about 10 or 12 feet away from a short-winged meadow katydid before he hears it. And I generally just don't hear them at all without using a device that lets me hear them better. So if you play it over the radio, you're going to have a lot of people not hearing anything. It's almost a test of how good your hearing is, and all the kids would perk right up and hear it, and then their parents would go, "There's nothing there."
Could I ask one more question?
Sure.
Here? And that is, do you know those like fluorescent lights that people put out to kill, they're supposed to be able to kill mosquitoes, but they really don't?
Yeah.
Are they still allowing those to be manufactured? Because they kill a lot of beneficial insects.
Right. I don't know of any laws in place to control those kinds of things. Do you, Will?
No, I don't. I see them everywhere.
Yeah.
And I hear them.
Yeah, and I think you're right, like not so much maybe the singing. Well, actually, lights do attract singing insects. I have a story. Would you like another story?
Yeah, let's have another one.
Well, there's a couple of katydids, the microcentrums. They're the angle wings. There's a greater and a lesser angle wing. And while we were doing this project, there was some of the species that are treetop singers, which these are, we were wondering, how in the heck are we going to, like, capture them so we can photograph them? How are we going to find them? They're way up in the tops of trees. They're not necessarily really common. So I went down, I was visiting Will, and we were talking about that. Maybe we should go to the New Jersey Pine Barrens, to a dwarf oak forest where they'd be singing from, and oaks and pines where they'd be singing from the tops of trees that are only 12 or 13 feet tall. That was one option, and then I took off and headed for Land Between the Lakes, Kentucky, to do insect recording and photography. And I was down there, and this one night I found a lesser angelwing singing from a sycamore leaf that was only about, oh, it was only about 8 feet up, 8 or 9, well, actually a little more, 12 feet or so, and I could see it up there. So I went and got a ladder, and I climbed up, and I tried to catch it by hand, and I missed it. And I was like, oh, you idiot, why didn't you use the bug net? You're like, you know, you blew your one chance at collecting a microcentrum. We didn't have any photographs. We had recordings, but no photographs. So I thought, well, got back in the car, and I was just talking to myself the whole time, you know, and really down on myself for missing this thing, not using the net. So I thought, well, I'll go drown my sorrows by drinking a Coca-Cola, because there's a Coke machine at this campground nearby. So I drove down to the Coke machine area right at the entrance to this campground. I was still giving myself, you know, trouble about this thing. I get out of the car, and then here on the Coke machine and on the walls of the building next to the Coke machine were both species of microcentrums, several specimens of each. And at that same Coke machine, the next year, Will was with me, and we went there again for a Coke, and we're standing there, and we heard this buzzing, and there was like a sodium vapor light right at the entrance. And we go, what in the world is that? And we look up, and there was like a bug buzzing around the light and hitting the light, and then it fell down into the ditch, and we looked at each other and said, cicadas. You know, they're not active at night, but drawn into this light, and we went over there, and we'd been having real trouble catching the dust-singing cicada, Tobison oletes, and there was a whole bunch of them in the ditch, only one of which was alive, which we photographed for our book.
Oh, great stories. Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger are guests today. They are co-authors of The Songs of Insects. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Giving you a little visual and oral journey through the insect world today with Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger, whose book, The Songs of Insects, is published by Houghton Mifflin. You've got the book itself with some fantastic photography, and as well, you have a CD of the songs of the crickets and the katydids and the grasshoppers and the cicadas. If you'd like to join in with your own questions or comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. You know, this summer, we'll see the emergence of the 17-year cicada in very southeast Wisconsin, Racine and Kenosha counties. Why is it every 17 years? Do we know?
Well,
yeah, for some reason that I don't know that is absolutely known, all of the individuals within a brood, these local populations, are synchronized. So when they hatch, they come up into the trees, they mate, the females lay eggs, the eggs mature and hatch in about 7 weeks, and these really tiny nymphs, about the size of small rice grains, rain down to the soil and burrow in, and they live on detritus and plant saps out of the roots for 17 years. And all that time, they're growing, going through all these different instars of development, and then within a three-day period, all of these individuals within this area, a brood, are synchronized, and they hatch out. They come out of the ground, crawl up on vegetation, hatch out of that last nymphal stage exoskeleton, and proceed as adults to mate. It's the wildest thing.
Yeah, but of course, why 17 years? That's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's addressed that, but we have a handful of periodical cicadas in eastern North America. They're either 13-year or 17-year.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. Mary in Fenimore has a commoner question about cicadas. Let's go to Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Mary, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
This is interesting. interesting. A few years ago, and I was trying to remember just how long it was, probably about 5 years ago, my parents live just south of Springfield, Illinois, and we went down there, and I don't know if it had to do at all with the variety of trees, but they had, and what they called them was the 17-year locust, and mm-hmm. I don't know if, I didn't realize there were so many different kinds. Mm-hmm. Is a locust and a cicada, are they the same?
Well, no. Cicadas should be called cicadas.
Okay.
Locusts are actually grasshoppers in the shorthorn grasshopper group.
Okay. Well, this is a cicada then.
Yeah, it was the 17-year cicada.
Okay. And it was like, I've never been in the tropics, but mm-hmm. it made me think of what it must be like in some tropical areas where they have so many insects. Because, I mean, it was just a roar uh-huh. Of that pulsing sound. I mean, it was constant it was during the day and kind of into the, you know, they didn't start real early in the morning, but they went quite a while towards dusk. I mean, it was just a constant thing. And I can remember my father taking a baseball bat and a bucket, like a 5-gallon bucket, and he would be banging at tree leaves, you know, at the branches, and mm-hmm. getting them in his bucket because they were just driving him nuts.
Right. Well, this was where now?
I mean, Southern
Illinois, or?
Pardon?
Where was it again?
Just south of Springfield, Illinois, in the country.
And where is Springfield? Is that?
It's the capital. It's right in the center of the state.
Right in the center.
Pretty
okay,
much.
Brood 10 would have come up in 1987 and 2004 there. I'm looking at the maps right now in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was going to say 5 years, but maybe it was longer than that. I don't know. I've lost track of time. But I just know that they were awful.
Right.
I mean, as a kid, I can remember finding the lone shells on a tree. We'd look for those, and you might hear, you know, a few. But this was just a huge infestation.
Well, most of the cicadas are what they call annual cicadas, meaning there are adults coming up every year. Even though the nymphs might take many, many years to develop underground, every year some emerge, shed their skins, and become adults. Mm-hmm. So that's non-synchronized, and therefore they are annual cicadas because you'll find adults each year, some years more than others, but mm-hmm. in general, you know, every year. While the periodicals just have synchronized development, mm-hmm. so they only come up like every 17 years or every 13 years. Now, in any one area, what they've separated them out is as broods. They started with one brood that they called Brood 1, and then mm-hmm. in subsequent years they named the broods by the year.
Mm-hmm.
And there are actually 13, for the 17-year cicada, there are 13 years that they can be found somewhere, so there's 13 broods. There's some years where you wouldn't find them. But in any particular area, you could actually have more than one brood. Like I think in North Carolina, there are at least several different broods where like over a 17-year period, you might get 3 chances to hear them, even though they're different broods. But in some areas like Central Illinois, I only see really brood 10 for 1987 and 2004 and 2021.
So maybe it was 2004.
It must have been 2004, but I had never experienced them in such a mass. And my question was, are they...
Well, how old are you?
Oh, I'm 65.
Oh, okay. Well, you've had a few chances.
But I've heard them, but I had never been any place where there were so many of them.
Yeah, it's
and
impressive.
So Are they attracted to certain varieties of trees more than others? Do you know?
Well, there's a history of the broods. Yeah, they have areas where the habitat originally, anyway, mm-hmm. must have been really good for them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's great numbers, but 17 years later, they're going to come up wherever they burrowed in.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the habitat could change. Like, you know, you could have a parking lot, and you'll have them trying to burrow up underneath the mm-hmm. pavement and couldn't get up. In the case where I did my photography of that species, I went to North Carolina, where there was a couple of cicada biologists working, and they had found an area that had been logged over and that had regenerated oaks that were about anywhere from 8 to 10 feet tall or 6 to 12 feet or something in height. And there was a huge bunch that were coming up in that area, mostly in tall forest, but in that logged over area, they were able to do their studies because they were coming up there and then going to the tops of these short little trees, and you could see them and study their mating behavior and everything.
Now, do they eat a ton of, you know, when they come out like that, are they going to devastate an area? Or?
Well,
no. The adults actually eat very little. They have a mouth part to pierce into the bark to suck up some of the phloem juices, some of the sap, and that keeps them alive. But basically, they don't chew leaves. They do very little damage in that respect. And when the females lay eggs, they're laying them in the ends of twigs. And it's like a natural pruning event. Now, if the tree is small, it could be significant. But a big tree, you know, in a mature forest, is just a pruning event for those trees.
Well, we're going to continue our discussion about cicadas, and we'll talk about a whole lot more in the insect world with our two guests, Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Talking about the songs of insects today with Lang Elliott and Will Hershberger, who co-authored the book The Songs of Insects, just out, published by Houghton Mifflin. Glad to have them along. And certainly you can join in if you have some questions for them as well at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Bill in Madison is next. And Bill, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. I grew up in Louisiana, and we'd wait for the cicadas to come up out of the ground, you know, and they'd usually come up at night, and they'd hang onto the barks of the trees, and they'd molt, and go out there and collect them. And when they're soft, you know, before the shells have had a chance to harden, right after they've molted, they're quite good eating.
Uh-huh. Who ate them? Did you eat them?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
And no, they don't taste like chicken. They're kind of, boy.
Would you quit buzzing, please?
Yeah, right. They're kind of like a little bit like crawfish, you know. But they put them in gumbo, or you can just fry them up.
Wow!
But when they're soft, when they've just molted, they're quite tasty.
Uh-huh.
I did not.
Well,
know
you're
that.
The first person I've ever met that has eaten cicadas. But how about you, Will? Is Will there?
Will, are you there? Oh, let's see. Let's try again. Will, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I haven't heard of anybody eating them, but I have heard that they have a nutty taste.
A nutty taste.
Well, we'll
so like a cicada gumbo.
Yeah, well, that's good.
Well, I mean, you know, the world over, people eat insects, and they are definitely very soft and you know, pretty. Yeah, I think that's when you would want to eat them. It's when they're just emerging, if you're going to try that, because once they form their shells, you'd have that problem. They also get pretty scary looking, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people have a great fear of cicadas, wouldn't touch one for anything, and yet, you know, they're completely harmless.
Well, let's try Mike and Seneca. Mike, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I have two questions here, if the time permits, on the last one. I would just like to know on your projects, if you use shotgun condenser mics, and what kind of is a tape, or do you use CD? What type of equipment do you record all this?
Yeah, well, most of the insects, especially the ground and shrub dwellers, we use shotgun mics. We used Sennheiser MKH 60 mics. They're high-end short shotgun, which allows you, like, if an insect is singing down on the ground under, in the grass or under a leaf or something, you can stick the shotgun mic right down there. You can insert it into a shrub and then get a lot closer to the singing insect. So the majority of our recordings were shotgun mic. But then for those that sing in the trees and higher up, like the cicadas and the microcentrum, angle wings, and some other species that are treetop, we used parabolic reflectors that would focus the sound and amplify the sound. And we recorded onto this whole project. It was all onto digital audio tape, DAT recorders.
Okay.
Recording at 48 kilohertz, 16-bit audio. Now we even can do better than that, but for this project, that was the main recording medium.
Okay. And Mike had another question?
Yeah, in my observation on particularly crickets, I know my grandmother always said that crickets make the noise by rubbing their back legs. Well, I noticed that they don't. A lot of these insects don't rub their legs. They actually kind of puff up their on their back part of their wing. It blows up and then vibrates. And I was just wondering, is that typical? Pretty much to make the sound.
Will, you want to take that?
Yeah, they have two pairs of wings, and the front pair of wings are modified. They're thicker, and one has a file on the bottom, and the other has a scraper on the top, and they rub that file and scraper across one another, and usually with the wings elevated, so it does look like it puffs up, but they're just elevating that front pair of wings. And as they rub the file against the scraper, it sends little membranes in the wings into motion, which creates and amplifies the sound.
Okay.
And the common sort of image of grasshoppers as fiddlers is actually correct, too, because the shorthorn grasshoppers, the ones that do sing or what they call stridulate, which means rubbing one thing against the other, rub their leg against the edge of a wing and get the sound that way. But all the crickets and katydids don't do that. That's wing on wing.
Mm-hmm.
And then certain of the shorthorn grasshoppers, it's leg on wing. And then the cicadas, it's special organs called timbals that are at the base of their abdomen.
Interesting. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Todd Witter, our producer for What Do You Know, is from Chicago and originally. And he says that Chicago residents often get together and cook up cicadas when they emerge. He's a native Chicagoan.
How about that? There's a whole cicada cooking subculture that we didn't know existed. But I would love to hear more about that, you know.
To get Todd on, he'll be the cicada cooking expert.
Do they do it primarily when the 17-year cicadas come up? Because otherwise it'd be sort of hard to get a lot of them unless you're really on top of it.
I assume that's the case.
Hmm.
But if Todd knows more, he'll probably call in and let us know. Let's go
What do these people look like?
Well, Todd's a pretty normal-looking guy.
They're
smart.
Pretty normal, huh?
Yeah, pretty normal.
What do they look like after dark?
No, pretty normal-looking guy.
Okay,
Mike in St. Lawrence, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Say, yeah, I remember, I think it was 2005 or the end of 2004, my son got married on Virginia Beach, and we traveled out there. We went up to the turnpike, the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and the cicada bugs were just all over the place.
Well, I see.
I mean, they would come into your windshield, and it was like a B-52 coming at you.
Well, Brood 10 came up around Washington, D.C., and up into Pennsylvania and Delaware and Maryland and parts of Virginia and West Virginia. That was a really big emergence that got a lot of national headlines.
Yeah, I remember that on CNN in the morning. And they talked about eating them back then, too, on CNN.
Yeah.
There were a lot of people that ate cicadas when they came up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You would think I would have heard people talking about that.
My question was that last night my wife and I were sitting outside on our deck, and we heard a sound, and we don't know if it was a bird or a frog but it was a high shrill, almost like a tree frog would make, the chirping, but it was just really loud, and there were like four of them around the woods. We live in 8 acres of woods.
And when was this?
This was, I would say, around 6:30, 6 o'clock in the evening.
Where was this?
Right here in Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah, over around southern Wisconsin.
Well, then right now, I mean, that would be a frog, not an insect, I would think.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what's trilling right now are American toads.
American toads. And it was loud. I mean, it was very loud.
Was it pretty, though, a pretty sound, or no?
Yeah.
American toad. They may trill for 15 to 20 or 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's what it was, American toad.
Yeah, that's the Thoreau referred to that as the dream of the toad. He wrote an essay called, said that started, "Today I heard the dream of a toad, or the dream of the toads, and he was talking about those trills, hearing them through the day while he was surveying somewhere up in the Northeast.
Okay. Yeah, I had the binoculars on. I'm trying to find a bird, and I'm looking. I said, boy, I can't see a bird up there anywhere.
Well, now, was it coming from the trees? That would actually be coming from pools near the ground.
No, yeah. This sounded like it was up in a tree.
Was it short little trills or longer?
I would say it was short, but it was one at a time. It was
And it that's a gray tree frog. I got it wrong. That's a Hyla versicolor gray tree frog, and they're coming in to breed, but when they come in, they call from the trees and the shrubs. Yeah, so gray tree frog. American toad would be a long trill. The gray tree frog would be just like a second, you know, below 2 seconds.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. And we'll take some more calls. You can join us, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Leonard in Woodruff, it's your turn. Hi, Len.
Hi. Listen, I just wanted to say that the people that are in for a big festivity in Naperville, Illinois, just west of Chicago, because I'm up there as well, and they are warning us to protect our small plants because the 17-year cicada are emerging right now. So it's just a little bit of information in that territory if anybody wanted to know. And I also enjoy your program so much. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Len. Thanks very much for coming.
I hadn't thought of the aircraft flying really low. I don't think the cicadas fly really high, but I think they might rise above the tops of the trees somewhat.
No.
Do you know, Will?
Yeah, a little bit, not very far.
I think, you'd have to be skimming the tops of the trees to have a problem with them.
Is there, it'd be fun to talk about on some of the habits of some of these insects that you photographed and write about. Are there some unusual habits that any of these insects have, or at least for you, that seem unusual?
Unusual habits. How about you, Will? Does something come to mind?
I mean, unusual habits. one of the things that's interesting is the confused ground cricket is a really small, black, typical cricket-looking insect. And for as loud as their songs are, they're extremely hard to see and capture. They sing in the leaf litter, particularly deciduous woods, oak wood leaf litter. And to try and catch one of these things, we had to resort to finding where it was singing, grabbing just an armful of the leaf litter, throwing it on a white sheet, and then sifting through every single leaf. And then we could find one.
It would always be under the very last leaf. Well, many of these have you know, unusual, like, natural history habits related to their lifestyle, like the mole crickets that live in burrows.
Yep.
And the northern mole cricket that you would have in Wisconsin, the males sing from burrows, and very often the burrow is plugged. Like they'll be singing from inside the burrow, and you'll hear the call, but if you try to find it, you can't, like, figure out where the heck the thing is. You could, like, with a shotgun mic, get the shotgun mic almost right over it, and then you look there, and there's nothing there, because it could be underground in the burrow with a little plug on the end of the burrow. So I find that quite unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual. Maybe they do it to, then how does the mate find them?
Well, Will, why don't you tell that story?
The mates burrow as well, and they'll burrow through the ground toward that singing male. If it's dark, so they avoid predators, and she's on the surface, she'll burrow down through that plug. But, they end up finding one another.
It's probably an anti-predator kind of thing.
Yeah, I would guess. Carol in Muscadet. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. I wanted to mention that I had observed people eating these things. I'm not sure if they were cicadas or locusts, but they were big, beautiful, shrimp-like, lime-green creatures.
Yeah, cicadas.
Okay, and they came out, and it was a great boon when in the country, Malawi, in southeast Africa, when they put in streetlights in Blantyre, the guys would put up their ladders against the lights and bring big bags and nets and collect those things, and they would also stick them live in their mouths and crunch them while they were, like they were picking ripe apples and eating them. And I always regretted that I didn't eat them there because they looked like shrimp. And from then on, I thought, you know, they must be the same kind of crustacean, you know, have the same kind of origins or something.
Well, you know, as you describe that, I'm not entirely sure they're cicadas, because the time to eat the cicadas, as was explained by the man from Louisiana, was it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is when you get them when they're hanging out of their shell, when they've just shed their skin, before they've consolidated their shell and it's hardened.
Mm-hmm.
Then they would be very soft and edible. But after that, a cicada, I'm not too sure if you would want to eat one that has a fully hardened shell. So it's possible, since other cultures, you know, especially in tropical areas like that, it could be any number of things that they were eating. I'm not sure that was a cicada.
Well, we call them locusts. People call them locusts, but it may have been a bad translation, you know.
And they would get them at night, or?
Yeah, at night. They'd come out at night, and they'd hang out under streetlights.
Interesting.
Yeah, sounds like maybe not cicadas, but I'm not totally sure.
Thanks, Carol.
You're welcome.
Sounds great, though.
Alice in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Larry. When I was a girl, a young girl, and I'm 83 now, they used to say, don't let that cricket in the house or it'll eat your clothing. Now, I'm wondering whether that's a true statement, and if the katydids and the locusts and any of those that we've been talking about this morning do the same thing, if that's it.
Okay.
Thanks. What do you think, Will? What do those crickets eat?
Mostly they eat plant materials, but I would imagine that they could eat cotton fiber, but most of the modern fabrics they wouldn't eat.
That's what I would think. They mainly go for dirty areas or, you know, when a cricket gets in the house. But do remember, like, the crickets that come into the house, for not for all species, but most of our crickets and katydids die off in the wintertime. They overwinter only as eggs. So if something gets in your house, it's probably coming in because it's warm, but it's destined probably to grow senile and finally die through the winter months. There are certain crickets that overwinter as nymphs, but I don't know in the North Temperate Zone, Do you know, Will, is there any example of one of the singing insects that overwinters as an adult?
No.
I don't think any. So really they're just coming in for the warmth, and their days are numbered.
Yep. Yeah.
I did have a cricket in my closet once, years and years ago, and I could never find the darn thing. And I wound up with some holes in my cotton shirt.
Mm-hmm.
So I was...
That was probably the moth that married the cricket.
Maybe. You know, you guys write about a katydid whose song is criminal, sort of.
That's right. Will, you tell that one.
You're talking about the robust?
The katydid, probably virtuoso.
The conehead katydids?
Oh, the coneheads. I see.
The robust conehead is it's so loud that the alarm system we have in the house here has a glass break detector, and this robust conehead will set it off. And that first night when I had it in the house to record the songs free of any background sounds for making the sonograms in the book, he started singing and set off the alarm, and I was wondering what was going on.
Yeah, I think the coneheads as a group... there's one that's called the slightly musical conehead, and let me tell you, that's stretching it.
Yeah.
As a group, they're very non-musical, piercing. We talk a little bit in the book about the possibility of keeping singing insects as pets.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can bring a meadow katydid or something in, and it'll sing for you, and you can feed it lettuce, and you could actually have a little insect chorus in your house clear into midwinter and sometimes beyond.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't recommend that anyone bring in the cone heads because they'll drive all your friends away.
they'll drive you crazy. They're very loud.
They'll drive you nuts, and they'll drive anybody else nuts, even though they may sing readily in captivity.
And you mentioned katydids, and there's one you write about that counts, so to speak.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yeah, that's the Scuderia pistillata, which is the broad-winged bush katydid. There's actually two species that sort of count. Well, one sort of counts, but this one really does. It makes these buzzy notes. This is at night, and may start with like two buzzy notes, and then there's a pause of 5 or 10 seconds, and it'll give three, and then a pause, and it'll give four, then it'll give five, six, and then maybe up to seven or beyond. It's really amazing, and in fact, I've gotten some biologists at Cornell University interested in this, Ron Hoy, who's a neurobiologist, and they want to study, a grad student is interested in this, to study the how they count. Like, how is this happening? It's very unusual among insects. And they have a hypothesis. Like I was asked, we had a lunch, and he said, well, what happens if you interrupt it before it finishes out the sequence? When it starts singing again, does it start at the beginning, or does it start where it left off? And I said, well, I don't know. I didn't do that. It takes a scientist, you know, to think of just a simple thing like that. I just recorded it, and... But they're intent to actually study the species and how it counts and perhaps why it counts, and it's an unusual thing.
Yeah, it sure is.
Track 54, if you want to play it.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
Track 54.
54.
Yeah.
All right, let's play that one. Get that up here.
Broad-winged bush katydid, Scuderia pistillata, a counting series of a cool male, followed by a counting series of a warm male, followed by lispy rattles.
And there it goes. And I know that people are going to have a hard time hearing that. So
yeah.
So we'll stop it there, but it I could definitely hear it. Of course I've got a headphone set on, so it was easy for me to hear it. Of the insects that you guys have recorded and photographed, which one in your minds has the prettiest song? Maybe we can end with that.
Well, I know the one that Will likes.
Yeah.
But it's not going to come over well on the radio, but he can talk about it.
Yeah, the common virtuoso katydid. One of these that was just recently described to science that had been lumped with another set of species has the most elaborate song of all of these katydids. It, one song can last 30 seconds, and it has some of the most complex sound segments given by any of the katydids. So that's my favorite, but it's a very high-pitched song.
Yeah, a lot of people would not hear it, And I don't know how much time we have, but we also have a story about how we mutually discovered that species for ourselves anyway.
Well, we've got about 30 seconds.
Go for it, Lang.
Well, neither one of us knew about it, and I went over to Kentucky, and lo and behold, I found this new bug, this new song, and got these great recordings, and I couldn't hardly believe it, and I rushed back to West Virginia to Will's, and I say, you got to hear this recording, you got to hear this recording, and he's saying, well, I found something you got to hear, too. And it turns out it was both the same thing.
Well, you guys, it sounds like you guys had a lot of fun putting this book together.
Oh, no, we didn't have any fun at all.
A lot of work, but a lot of fun. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, Larry, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks very much. Lang Elliott and Will Hirschberger, our guests, author of this really interesting book. It's called The Songs of Insects, The Songs of Insects. And it's published by Houghton Mifflin, and some great stories about insects in the book, and some wonderful photography. You won't believe the photography and the sounds. We've been hearing quite a few of them today, and it was a lot of fun listening to those songs. And that CD is available, comes with the book, and I think it's right around $20 for the whole thing. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.